Welcome to the Consulting Growth Podcast. I'm Professor Joe Omani, a professor of consulting at Cardiff University and an advisor to consultancies that want to grow. If you'd like to find more out about me and access some free resources to help your consultancy grow, do please visit joeomani.com. That's joeomahoney.com. Okay, welcome back, everyone. I'm here with Pritul Kagram, who is a director at PwC, but prior to April this year, was the founder and CEO of PeopleForce, a HR solutions and platform provider supporting especially Ceridian Dayforce, which many of you may have heard of, which sort of specializes in HR payroll and benefits. And Pritul has very kindly given us some time out of his day, especially after a long client meeting, to talk to us about him and his journey. And Pritul, welcome and thanks for your time.
Thank you for having me.
Could you tell us a little bit about your background prior to consulting? I know you were in the people space for quite a while before you started PeopleForce.
Yeah, sure. So I am actually an HR professional. So I worked as an HR director for a global consulting firm called SoftGen. It operated within the banking software consultancy space. But I was global HR director for that organization, had been there for 9 years and saw that company through growth by acquisition. So I led a lot of the HR due diligence and integration processes for that organization globally, had a global team. And yeah, and that's what I did before PeopleForce. And yeah, then obviously PeopleForce was a lifelong dream to set up something from scratch, supporting clients in the people technology space. So essentially linking the two components together, the human resources or people, human capital, if you like, with technology. And that was the primary objective of PeopleForce.
Okay. And did you, thank you. And did you start off PeopleForce with a view to grow it? And if so, did you start off doing what you ended up doing, if you see what I mean?
Yes, I think the aim was to start something from scratch and to build it over a number of years. And at some point in the future, someone will see some value in it and will want to buy us out. And that essentially was the overall aim, yes, but there was never, ever a timeline attached to that. And
sure,
for me, that, you know, you can't set yourself a deadline. And then if you can't meet it, you shoot yourself in down or something like that. It's so it was kept with an open mind. Timeline was never something that we set.
Okay. And obviously moving from SoftGen to starting up by yourself must have been a bit of a shock in terms of, you know, well, everything, really, I guess. What were the challenges when you first started up and how did you address those?
Sure. So obviously a lot of challenges when you're setting up a business for yourself. It was, there's always challenges such as how am I going to earn enough, let's say, income to justify doing this? How am I going to convince clients to use our services when actually we don't have a background, when I'm really essentially selling myself and my background at that point in time? So those were some of the challenges, but I overcame that by ensuring that I had some income coming in right from the word go. So I was actually assigned myself as an interim HR director for another consultancy, which became our client for a couple of times a week. And this meant that there was constant flow of income coming in, whilst it also gave me an opportunity to develop and build a solid foundation for PeopleForce.
Sure. Okay. And but even so, even with a good income coming in, I'm guessing you weren't able to just walk out and hire 50 people from scratch. And so how did you plan the recruitment side of, I mean, this is your specialism, of course, but how did you plan the recruitment side of things, given that good people are pretty pricey in that space?
Yeah, so the way I took it is that I knew that I would have to invest time and money into building something that I had huge plans for. So as a driven individual, I did want to ensure that this isn't just a one-man band, if you like, or I'm not just a limited company selling myself, my services out to organizations and then continue doing that forever. I mean, you know, you could do that. There's lots of people that do that, but I wanted to aim higher. And because of that, I had to sacrifice on the personal income that I took for the first year or two, much lower than what I got as an HR director for a global banking software consultancy, for example. But that's the sacrifice I made. And this allowed me to use some of the income that I was getting from my first kind of consulting gig, if you like, as an interim HR director 2 days a week for, I think this was a year and a half to 2 years, actually. So using that income that I was getting to ensure that I did have staff that I was able to fund their salaries, essentially.
Well done. It's obviously an investment that's paid off, but not one that you necessarily knew was going to pay off at the time. So it takes some bravery to do that, doesn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And it's a commitment. I had the support of my family as well. That was very important, I think, because I had this vision and I explained this vision to them. And they know my character in that if I set myself to do something, I will go and do it. Yes, it's never going to be an easy ride. So it's always going to be, you know, blood, sweat and tears. But their support towards me was quite vital in this. And so that was important.
You've clearly got a strong work ethic that comes across, not just with your success, but chatting to you now. How did you cope with the dilemma that some founders have that they can't pull themselves away from the details, which does obviously limits the growth of the company and lots of other things and the development of the people? Did you find that was a challenge, or were you quite, had you been there and done that and seen it before?
Indeed, it was a challenge, and I found myself getting involved in too much detail. And there came a point where I had to ensure that the right people are hired and that I trust them to do their job. Also, in the early stages, what I was doing is I was selling our services, but also delivering our services. And that is kind of an approach that an independent contractor would typically take. And I found I was doing that. And as a result, I was seeing that our sales pipeline was suffering. So about 5 years into the PeopleForce journey, we hired a finance director. We hired an accountant, essentially, to become the finance director. Mm-hmm. And he subsequently became a business partner, invested in the business. He saw the direction we were going, et cetera, et cetera. So that was great. And one of the things that me and him discussed was that I need to remove myself from delivery, that I need to concentrate on the business development side, because that was a strength, and delivery, we can hire good people to be able to do the doing. And so we shifted that. So I slowly moved out of doing project work and more into business development, relationship building, etc. And we just hired a good delivery team. And that had to be done in a calculated way. You can't just hire lots of people, because there's a huge risk there. And I wanted to ensure that our hiring model was one of permanent staff rather than associates and contractors. And I found that clients really valued that, because if got permanent staff that are with us, then they're vested, it's their job, and there's not that much of a risk of them disappearing off onto their next contract as well.
Sure. I'm guessing your experience with SoftGen, with the due diligence side of things at least, and your prior experience in HR generally and consulting, meant that you probably made fewer mistakes on the people side of things. So I'm guessing, what insights did your HR expertise give you in building a successful company?
I think it was culture. So culture was the number one agenda on my priority list throughout my tenure at PeopleForce. And I ensured that as the company started to grow, we hired more and more people, that the culture didn't get lost in that. And I think that was key. And people actually joined PeopleForce because they heard about the culture. They heard about the fact that the senior leadership team at PeopleForce have the ethos of take good care of people, and people will take care of clients and business, et cetera, et cetera. And so that was, I think, very, very key. Creating culture.
Okay. And how did you, so again, another challenge a lot of founders have is you've gone from a big firm to a small one. No one's really heard of you on the people side of things. So how did you find the right people in terms of getting that top of the pipeline? I don't mean clients, I mean your employees. How did you find sufficient good people that fitted with the culture? If perhaps, I don't know, big advertising campaigns and big branding campaigns perhaps weren't possible.
And I think because we worked in niche market, if you like, the HR technology or people technology, there's a lot of people out there that you come across in your career. You know of them. So a lot of people we did hire that we did know from previous experiences, or they were recommended. But the other thing that we did is we ensured that from an interviewing point of view, we got the right people to interview candidates. And we had this internal saying where the person is people force material. And there was never a definition. We never wrote down what people force material actually means. Yep. But everyone at People Force knew exactly what that meant.
It's interesting.
And that was key. So every time someone is interviewed, they will always, as part of the feedback, say, yes, this person is people force material.
Okay, that's really interesting. Because very often it's the opposite in that you'll get a firm that's got 20 points about their values and beliefs and unique employee proposition. But actually, when you look at them work, it's not played out in real life.
Yeah, exactly. And so that's so you see, as we started to grow more and more, I took part in less interviews myself, and we had senior managers that did final interviews and things like that. And the feedback was always, yes, this person's people force material, or no, this person's not. And that's all I needed to hear. Then I kind of trusted the judgment of the senior management team and authorized the hiring. And then once they're on board, as I said before, maintaining a great culture was key. And that helped retain key staff.
Great. Brilliant. Thank you. I want to talk a little bit about the journey. So in terms of, I mean, you'd obviously done due diligence with other firms and you'd been part of different types of firms prior to People Force. Were there any things that were quite challenging on the growth journey? I mean, obviously you went through two or three recessions, I guess. And how did you, I don't mean to put recessions front of mind, but any challenges that you had and how you overcame them in terms of the growth journey?
So obviously one of the biggest challenges we experienced was the pandemic. And we felt that at the start of the pandemic, we didn't know what was going to happen. That was a very, there was this general feeling of nervousness across the industry. But actually, we felt that the pandemic was actually hugely beneficial for us as a business. We changed our delivery model. So a lot of work we used to do on site before, we changed it to remote. A lot of soon got used to it, as did the entire world. And that was interesting because what we did is we changed from a daily rate charge concept perspective to an hourly rate.
That's interesting.
And whilst in the consulting industry, a lot of organizations and clients are used to paying daily rates, we felt that actually by having a remote delivery model, predominantly remote delivery model, certainly during the pandemic, but post-pandemic, we continued this and it changed more into a kind of a hybrid going forward. Yep. But even then we said, right, we're charging hourly rates now, not daily rates, hourly rates. This means that if we're doing a piece of work for client A, that's 2 hours today, they're getting charged for 2 hours as opposed to a whole day. And we felt that actually clients valued that because they're not paying a whole day. They're paying for what they're getting.
Yep.
It also meant that we can serve client B on the same day. And client C and so on, and charge them all hourly rates. And we felt that actually that model started to become standard.
That's really interesting. Okay. I've never heard of someone making that change. I've heard of people going to fixed pricing or value-based pricing, but I guess it also ensures on your side that, you know, you've got very detailed attention to timesheets and people filling them in, and it's no point having the hourly charges if no one's billing properly.
Absolutely. And there's fixed prices as well. We did a lot of fixed price work as well. Yeah, but even on fixed price, we still needed consultants from our side to log time. And the time logging concept we found as a challenge as well, because if people are coming from industry into consulting, they're not used to that. They're not used to the concept of logging time and the fact that time is money and so on and so forth. So that takes a bit of adjustment. And we needed to ensure that we relayed very clearly why it's important in the consulting space to do this, why it's necessary, why it's done real time and accurately, et cetera, et cetera. So we introduced good tools to be able to, user-friendly tools to be able to give the consultants the right tools to keep this updated regularly. So I think that's important.
Thank you. It's really interesting. And I want to fast forward a bit to the, you know, the last year or so, if that's okay. And obviously, I don't want to talk details, but I'd be interested to know if you used a broker or a bank for the transaction, and if so, how you went about finding them, and any advice you'd give other people in terms of, there's loads of people who will help you sell your firm and find the right buyer, but how on earth do you choose between all the potential offerings out there?
Yeah, so interestingly, we were not actively looking to sell the business at the time that it happened, right? So it means that we did not appoint an agent or anything like that to help us find a buyer. Our situation was very different in that we had PwC and two other firms, in fact, that reached out to us directly.
Okay.
And we had relationships with these firms as well. So it wasn't cold. I mean, we had lots of agents that used to reach out to us to say that, they've got a potential buyer. And
sure.
I didn't really welcome those conversations because, as I said, we were not actively looking to sell. And I suppose what drew these organizations that approached us was the fact that we became Ceridian's leading implementation partner in the EMEA region. We had the largest practice size. We had the most number of end-to-end Dayforce implementations. We managed to attract good people from overseas and brought them to the UK. So we demonstrated our commitment to Ceridian, which meant that actually we got a lot of project opportunities. And because of this, we created a situation where we were, like I said, the leading implementation partner in the ecosystem. And there were other partners also within the same ecosystem and outside of it that were watching us to see how we were doing and progressing.
Okay.
And so that led them to reach out to us to discuss possible acquisitions. So we didn't actually need to use a broker or an agent for that reason because we had relationships already.
Okay, great. Well, it's good that you had two or three companies reaching out. Why did you choose PwC? What was it about them that you thought this is the one?
Sure. That's a good question. So it's very flattering when you have two or three organizations
sure.
reach out, and it actually happened in the space of a month. In fact, it was even more overwhelming. And so because we were in a position where we had choice, we wanted to ensure that when selling a business, we ensure that it goes in the right hands, right? And it's no different from, let's say, if you're giving away your baby. You want to make sure that it goes in, that the parents that will take care of them going forward indeed going to be the right ones. So we, as part of that, we had that principle in mind. We wanted to make sure that the culture is. So I spoke earlier about how culture was a number one priority for us at PeopleForce. I wanted to ensure that the buyer's culture, it was equally good and important to them. And that was very important. The huge difference is that PwC is a huge corporate multinational organization.
Sure.
And we were at PeopleForce, we were a boutique consultancy. Yeah. So that was always going to be the case in terms of whenever we did sell PeopleForce, it was always going to be to a bigger business. We didn't know, the size of the business at the time, but I think it's important that things like there's alignment in culture. There's alignment in things like people development and giving people a clear career path to be able to succeed and opportunities. And so those were some of the things that we looked at in really pursuing things with PwC over others.
Yeah, well, they've got a great brand. They've got a great reputation. And I'm sure because of their size, there's so many synergies that must be possible that simply aren't possible for a smaller boutique.
Absolutely. I mean, the power of the PwC network of firms, which are over 150 firms globally, over 300,000 people globally, and 25,000 people in the UK alone, you can imagine the number of clients and relationships that the firm has globally. And this is just absolutely fascinating because we are able to generate opportunities internally within PwC. And so those kind of opportunities we would never have had, of course. And the kind of clients that PwC attract and also deal with and have been dealing with over a number of years, again, like I said, in the PeopleForce, we would not have had an opportunity to work with those types of clients. So,
I often see it from the other way, where people from, say, PwC or Deloitte or even McKinsey or Bain, they leave and start up by themselves, and they're almost used to clients phoning them and saying, "Can you come and do some work?" And all of a sudden, no one knows who they are, and it's a big psychological shock. So it's quite nice to see it happening the other way, of course.
Absolutely. Yeah, I can imagine that, because that's a position I was in setting up solo as a consultancy. Mm. When I set up PeopleForce, obviously I didn't come from a big four consulting background at the time, but it's no different. You're setting up something from scratch and you're having to develop and you're having to prove to people that actually it's worth buying your services.
Yeah.
And people always question why.
Tough, isn't it? Yes. I've known a couple of clients in the past where I've helped them grow and then they've gone off by themselves. And they're probably, a couple of them might be thinking about when they get approached, do I need to pay 2-3% to a broker in order to do this? I'm quite interested in your experience there. Is there any advice you would give for founders and owners that decide perhaps they get approached like you were? Perhaps they're very comfortable with one specific partner, but in terms of the process, because obviously one benefit of having a bank or a broker to deal with things is that they take off some of the work in terms of everything, really. So is there any advice that you would give founders or owners in terms of not using that type of broker?
Yeah, so what we did is we didn't use a broker, because a broker suggests that it's an organization that is trying to find a buyer for an organization that's selling, or find an organization for someone that is looking to buy, right? Yep. They're marrying the two up. So we didn't need that. But the moment we agreed to pursue things with PwC, we did appoint an advisor. Now, the advisor that I used was someone that I had worked with for a number of years myself. So the person was trusted. I knew they knew how I operate and I knew how they operate. And they had had lots of M&A experience as well. So had been there, done that, including with the top four. So having that advisor that has been there, done that for a number of different organizations was key, and brought us credibility as well. Because when you're an owner manager of a small boutique consulting firm and a huge organization like PwC wants to buy you, it can be overwhelming. And so the fact that we were able to bring an advisor brought us credibility, and it meant that we were able to use him to kind of have certain discussions that perhaps might be quite sensitive.
Yep.
And because then going forward, we need to have we need to maintain a relationship, you know, because we will then be colleagues. So it's always great to have that external advisor that's helping you through the transaction. So that's one thing. Then obviously that advisor is not an expert in all areas. So that person will not be a corporate lawyer. That person will not be a tax expert, etc. So you will need to ensure that you have good solicitor's firm that is helping you structure the deal and is helping you review and negotiate aspects of the sales purchase agreement, SPA, but and also someone else that is also giving you good tax advice as well. So there's those three: M&A advisor, legal representative, and tax advisor.
Great. I'm worried about your time, because we both know due diligence isn't an easy thing to do, but obviously it didn't distract you from business development and running the firm, because it would have been a successful deal. How did you deal with the sheer amount of information requests coming from a big beast like PwC?
So it was a different level of intensity, I must add. And we had to ensure that business as usual was continuing. We had to ensure that we went through the due diligence, and only a handful of people within PeopleForce knew about it at the time. So we had to also maintain confidentiality as well. It was different. So it was difficult. It was different in that you had to put in more hours. So for example, we had to cancel Christmas. We had to work weekends. We had to work long hours. We needed to balance a lot of things. And yes, of course, the information request for a firm like PwC is going to be very, very comprehensive. And, you know, they had a huge team working on the due diligence at their side. So, and we knew that this would be the case. But I think what is important is that because I set up the business originally 10 some years ago with this ultimate aim, without a timeline, without a set timeline, it was, I suppose, subconsciously, you always knew that there's going to be due diligence coming up at some point.
Sure.
And so therefore, you want to make sure that you've got your house in order right from the get-go. And that is important. And we started to do that so that a lot of the information they were requesting, we did have. But as a small organization, you know, you don't have lots of fancy tools that you're just able to tap a few buttons and out comes the information that they're...
Sure.
So we had to do a lot of manual work as well. But having your house in order in a much early stage, especially if you know what your end goal is, I think is important.
I think that's such a wonderful piece of advice, especially for people that are thinking of starting up or have just started up. Yeah. It's very easy to say, well, let's leave the systems and processes until we've got 20 people or 30. But then it's quite a major distraction. And some of the most successful firms I've seen start from the beginning in that professional sense. So good on you. I guess with your background, you probably knew that in the first place, didn't you?
Yeah, I think, yeah, exactly. Exactly that. And I knew that and I wanted to make sure that everything's in order so that it makes it as smooth as possible. I would imagine that it would have been even much more stressful if we didn't have it in order.
Sure.
So, yeah, it's like I say, huge level of intensity during that period, but we knew there was an end goal and we knew that we were getting close to that end goal. So therefore we put in that effort during that due diligence stage.
Yeah, great. Well, listen, Pritul, thanks so much for your time and congratulations once again. It's no small achievement, as you know, and blood, sweat and tears go into building successful companies. So I'm so pleased it came off well for you.
Thank you very much. And thank you very much for having me on.
Best of luck. Take care. Bye-bye.
Take care, bye.
As ever, thank you for listening to the Consultancy Growth Podcast. This is Professor Joe Omani at joeomani.com.